You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com. Have you ever wondered what it's like inside a screenwriter's mind? In this podcast, we explore how successful screenwriters tackle structure, plot, character, dialogue, and the film business. Get ready to go down the rabbit hole of story as we pull the best interviews from the archives of the IFH Podcast Network. Let's travel inside the screenwriter's mind. This episode originally aired on the Indie Film Academy podcast.
Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart.
Actually, first got interested in mythology in about the fifth grade. And we had a teacher who every day after lunch would make us sit down at the desk and put our little heads down. And she would read to us for about 30 minutes or so. And she read over the course of the year the entire Iliad and Odyssey. Hmm. And I was so caught up in the stories. I thought, oh, these are great stories. Mm-hmm. And that started my early interest in mythology. But it was more of a, you know, just, wow, what great stories. Right. And then I studied Latin and took a degree from the University of Texas at Austin in English and Latin with film studies also, went to the film school there. So, you know, it was always kind of sort of combining them, but the lights never quite went on a direct connection. Mm-hmm. And then some years later, when I was actually doing freelance work in the aerospace business, as well as doing commercials and music videos. And I was taking these classes here in Los Angeles at the Philosophical Research Society. And it was classes on comparative mysticism. So there was a lot of mythology in it. And there came a time when the teacher said, okay, what I want you to do is to figure out a way to put this information into your professional world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people were already into therapy, or they were doctors, or they were lawyers, or this or that. But a lot of us were in media. And in looking at what we've been learning, we've been studying the chakras and all about how whichever chakra you're coming from will determine, you know, how you interact with the world. I thought, how am I going to make this stuff work? And character development. Right. And so that was when the big lights went on for me, was that characters are all about emotion, and a good story engages us emotionally with the characters. And if you're building stories, you know, analyzing them is one thing, but when you're building stories, what a clever tool to use the chakras, because you've got this wide range of emotional response to and interaction with the world. You know, ranging from the root chakra. Oh, and all these things, by the way, are actual physiological things. It's nerve clusters up and down your spine that connect to endocrine glands that shoot out the hormones, whether it's adrenaline or testosterone or any cortisol, any of those internal factors that affect us psychologically.
Now, can what just for like 101 for those of us who are kind of outside of like, can you give me just a general basic description of what you mean when you say a chakra?
Absolutely.
And because I'm a little behind on this whole, whole concept.
Well, the good news is there's a whole lot out there once you start looking on the chakras. It's a very ancient system of medicine and character analysis, philosophy, and psychology. So the chakras basically are these clusters of nerves up and down your spinal column that are connected to endocrine glands that control the hormones in your body. And the easiest example is the root chakra at the very bottom of your spine is all about survival, fight or flight. And glands that it's connected to are the adrenal glands, which put out adrenaline. And so when you're frightened, you get this big shot of adrenaline and it perks you up and you're ready to run or to fight. Well, you can also stimulate that, as you can stimulate a lot of the chakras, with food and drink. So you drink coffee or any kind of caffeine and it stimulates that adrenal system, stimulates your root chakra, and you're ready to take on the world. Or you get so stressed out because the world is taking you on. And then you move up to the sacral chakra, and you've got the reproductive organs and the testosterone and the estrogen and all of those. And, you know, moving on up, it's sort of developmental psychology based on actual physiological mechanisms in your body that once you start consciously working with it, then you can use them to, let's say, have better control of your own emotions. Right. Also observe other people's and work with them, addressing where they're actually coming from. I've taught the chakra system to the military in leadership courses, and figuring out where somebody's coming from, then you can speak to them in that particular language and have a better communication with them.
Right. Is that related to like where your power is coming from?
Jason, it is very much so. And a lot of people run across this system when they study martial arts. And then if any of your listeners have ever had acupuncture or acupressure or sometimes even chiropractic, then it's working with that same nervous system, the nerves and glands of your body.
Right.
Okay. And so it's a wonderful way, without getting medical at all. Coincidentally, I have written a book about it called Inner Drives. And it's all about how to use these chakras to create characters that are unique one from another. And it can go through character arcs by moving up and down the chakra system.
Okay. Now, I'm imagining that at this time, our listeners are saying, okay, what does this have to do with filmmaking?
Well, if you don't have interesting, engaging characters, nobody's going to watch your films.
Right. That's what I think is really interesting about, you know, the way that you approach this is that, you know, it is a very different way of understanding character and motivation and things like that.
It is, but it's also once you, and it doesn't take long. I teach seminars about it. I also teach acting and directors how to use the chakras. The most interesting exercise that we do is do the explanation, obviously more in depth than what we're doing here, but do the explanation of them and then show a film as an example of characters on each particular chakra. And then we do this fascinating exercise. So I'll have like a 2 or 3 page scene, and I say, okay, Jason, you're going to be coming from the lower solar plexus, which is all about personal power. And you're going to be playing, you know, George. And then the other person, I'd say, okay, you're going to be playing Sally, and she's coming from a different chakra. And so you play the scene that way because you've seen how that particular chakra expresses. And they say, okay, now we're going to shift to different chakras. Same scene, same lines of dialogue. And you do this 3 or 4 times, and you really see what an amazing difference it can make delivering a line coming from a different place of power, a different focus of consciousness.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
All right. That sounds pretty amazing, actually.
It's astonishing. I get chills every time we do these exercises in the classes because it's just so obvious.
Now, to kind of solidify it, you mentioned that you look at films. Uh-huh. Are there any films that you can reference as an example of this kind of way of looking at characters?
Well, yeah, certainly all films have some aspects of it. I will tell you that one of the examples that I show, and let me just update it with some of the most recent films. For the root center, which is the chakra at the very bottom of the spine, it's all about survival and killing and life or death situations. Mad Max, Fury Road.
Mm-hmm.
Almost every character in that movie is on that lower chakra. And they're just trying to survive. But you have Furiosa, who is at a higher center because she is leading people out of a bad situation. So she's up at what's called the aspirational solar plexus, where you start reaching out to help others. It's not just about me, me, me anymore. So there's an example there. Then one of the fun examples I show is from the movie Moulin Rouge with Nicole Kidman and Ewan McGregor. Mm-hmm. And there's that wonderful seduction scene in her suite. And he's at the throat chakra, which is all about art and conscious creativity. That's where all your filmmakers will be. Anybody who's consciously creating something is doing it from their throat center.
Hmm.
And, oh, yeah, it's so fascinating. So he's a poet. So he's coming from this throat center, and he's there to read her his poem and his work that he hopes will, you know, they'll put it on there as a show. And she thinks he is a duke there to, enjoy her favors in return for investing in the show.
Mm-hmm.
So she does this elaborate, outrageous seduction scene, and he has no idea why she's doing it. He's just standing there kind of gawking at her, and there's a wonderful shift in her energy when she realizes that he's holding a different focus. He's at a higher level than she is, and this is not good or bad, but just a higher frequency.
Mm-hmm.
And when he starts singing his poetry to her, you can see, it's a beautiful scene, you can see her begin to realize that there's something more going on here. And by his injection of poetry into what otherwise was a comic sexual scene, starts to lift her up into that higher, more romantic as opposed to just sexual frequency. Mm-hmm. And it's really beautiful. And then there's a great line at the end of it when she goes, oh, you're brilliant, you're handsome, you're talented, and you're a duke. He goes, Duke, I'm not a duke. I'm a writer. And she just looks at him horrified and says, a writer? Yeah, and it always gets bigger.
Yeah, I know that. I know that feeling.
Yeah, really, really. So I would suggest to your listeners to watch that particular scene. And they'll get a very good example of people coming from different chakras and how they interact, and then how one person's position alters another person's position. Because what we want out of our characters is for them to change.
Can you, when you watch a movie, are you just sitting there going, oh, let me figure out his chakra? And, you know, do you just, I imagine you watching films kind of like seeing The Matrix, like you see all the underlying things happening. Can you just go and watch a movie and enjoy it?
Oh, it's so difficult. For many years, I was in production and, you know, directed and produced and, you know, AD and all this. Fortunately, I've had a wonderful career in the film business and have done, I'd say, every job on a film set except sound mixing and lighting. And I figure you really want the experts when you're handling electricity. But through the course of that, I find it really difficult, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners do too. Once you know anything about how films are made, it's hard to watch a film without deconstructing it in your mind as you're watching it. And when I first saw Inception and all the intricate sets and everything that happened, my first thought was, oh, I'm so glad I'm not the production designer or the AD. What a nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing to watch a lot of these really higher budget movies. And once you have a concept of how much is going into it, it just kind of is like, wow. You know, you know, I'm into making indie films, and, you know, I can kind of put my head around how much we're spending on things and how many different takes we did and angles and shots and how long it took to create all these giant CG, you know, sequences and things like that. But I mean, I went to go see Civil War last night.
Oh,
the Avengers movie.
Uh-huh.
And look, it came out here actually a week earlier than in the U.S. So it's here. It's kind of cool. It never happens. Everything comes here like a week and like weeks later, or even sometimes a year later. But I was just watching that. And yeah, if you have any notion of how all the things, I don't have any idea how they put some of those, you know, gigantic action sequences together, because it just seems complete chaos, but it all works, you know?
Mm. Yeah. And I think,
anyway, I got off topic. Sorry.
Well, actually, no, because you reminded me of something that, I think anybody who's been in the business for any number of years can see, and that is, and I'll say the same, it's the same for production as it is for story. There are certain standards, there are certain protocols that come up whether you're doing an indie film with no budget or you're doing a $100 million film.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain things that just hold true across that spectrum. And you know, part of it is you got to put something in front of a lens, and you've got to capture images. And there are certain ways to do that that are more effective than others. And as with story, you need to have theme, you need to have character changes, you need to have goals, you need to have barriers, you need to have resolution. one of the things I like to say is you need SDS, sympathy, danger, and then salvation. So you've got to engage us with your characters. We need to be sympathetic toward them, or at least curious about them.
Mm-hmm.
And then there needs to be danger, because without danger, there's no story. There's no conflict. And mm-hmm. then salvation, or let's say resolution. So there needs to be some kind of satisfactory ending. It doesn't have to be a happy ending, but some kind of satisfactory ending. So if you don't have all three of those elements, and if they don't correspond and resonate among themselves, then your story's not going to be very satisfying. It might not even be a story. It might just be a mishmash. So, you know, whether you're working at a major studio or doing a web series in your garage, the same elements apply. The same basic foundational elements apply.
Yeah, it's been interesting to see some of these really high budget films that have just completely flopped recently. You know, I try to see everything, and that is really, you know, what you're saying is dead on, because the real difference between, and you could look at like Deadpool as a perfect example of something that works because you care about the character, you care about what's happening to him. And then I don't want to name names of movies that are terrible, but you know which ones they are.
We all have a list. Yes.
Yeah. But it's like you don't connect with anybody, and it's like a lot of stuff happens, you know? And it's funny. I was talking to my son the other day, and he's only 8, but he was like, Dad, why didn't you like this movie or that movie? And I was like, because, you know, we watch movies all the time. And I was like, a lot of stuff happened, but I didn't care about any of it. Nothing felt like it was at risk. I wasn't concerned with the characters, whatever. And it just looked like a corporation built the thing like a big Frankenstein, you know?
Yes. And too often that happens. And I'm fortunate to have spent first years out in Hollywood. I was 4 years at Universal Studios and started out in the typing pool back when you used to type scripts. I'm really lucky to work with Joel Schumacher.
Oh, okay.
And I worked on the first film that he directed, which was The Incredible Shrinking Woman with Lily Tomlin. And it was a long production because there was a lot of special effects. And at that time, it was not CGI. It was actual real special effects.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so interesting to see not only that, but also how the many fingers of the studio execs would come down and stir the pie on stage. And you can watch it. You know, when you see a movie, you think, okay, I know what happened around the table when they were having this part of the story meeting.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Because you can see so many different people's agendas in a film. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think the ones where the director can hold out for their vision are often the most powerful films. And my favorite film of all time is Apocalypse Now.
Oh, okay. Yeah, definitely.
Definitely had the director's vision all the way through.
Yeah. Probably the most ever.
Yeah. True that. But, you know, I mean, just as an example of what I just said, look how many directors, when they have the chance, bring out the director's cut, which implies that the other cut that got out there first was not theirs. Writers find, and directors also, and this is in what people tell me, as well as just in my own experience, when you have the confidence that your story has a mythological foundation. When you're using mythic themes and archetypes and symbols and these classical tools of storytelling, they're still around, the stories are still around because they work, then it's easier for you to stand up and say, interesting idea, but it doesn't work with this particular theme. Or that would be off type for this archetype, which is what this character is portraying. So just having that confidence of your story being grounded in the classic tools of storytelling can go a long way on a set or in the story meetings or in the exec suites.
Now that we've started talking about mythology, one of the things that obviously we want to really dig into is mythology and the classic stories that we're retelling over and over again. And I think that a lot of people, whenever they hear mythology in filmmaking, they instantly associate Joseph Campbell and they instantly start thinking about the hero's journey because, you know, a lot of people in my generation, we all, you know, we learn filmmaking from things like Star Wars, you know, and then you've got all these other classic stories, Harry Potter and all these things that are like, oh, okay, well, that's just the hero's journey. Or we have things like Save the Cat and all these other kind of pre-built structures. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I thought was really fascinating about what you cover is that you're talking about all of the things that are not like the hero's journey is just one way to go. But can you talk a little bit about the way you approach mythology and filmmaking and storytelling?
Yes, thank you. And first, I would agree with you and also give praise to Joseph Campbell for how he popularized mythology. Mm-hmm. And also, Chris Vogler has done a wonderful, wonderful job of taking that hero's journey paradigm. And his book, Writer's Journey, is very, very helpful.
Yeah, that's a great book.
It's a fabulous book, and I highly recommend it. But as Joseph Campbell himself said a couple of years after the Hero with a Thousand Faces came out, which was his, this is the monomyth, The Hero's Journey, came back later and said, well, there are other mythic themes. And I just wrote these four books about it. So, you know, here you go. So what I have been working with is what I call Beyond the Hero's Journey, Other Powerful Mythic Themes. And some of them are, come up with a few with current movie references. And there's The Search for the Soulmate. And you've got Brooklyn and Best Exotic Marigold Hotel as examples of that theme. Mm-hmm. You've got The Great Escape, where a person or often a group of people has to escape from something. And you've got in current films, you've got Bridge of Spies, you've got The Martian, you've got Revenant. A very, very prevalent mythic theme is the wake-up call. And that's where someone doesn't know who they are. And then someone lets them know, or through their own bumblings around, they figure out, you know, what I'm doing isn't working. I need to try something different. Or there is part of that hero's journey thing, you know, the call to action. So they get that, but it's a different kind of story. It's more the character waking up to who they are. And you've got King Arthur, you've got Moses, you've got Luke Skywalker. And then most recently, Star Wars, The Force Awakens you know, right there it is in the title. It's a wake-up call. And then a charming version of that, which also uses the chakras, is Inside Out.
Mm-hmm.
And those little animated embodiments of the girl's emotions it's the chakra system. And the one in control is the Ajna, which is the central controller of the chakras. It's really fascinating to look at it from that point of view. And another very prevalent theme throughout many cultures and times is the search for the promised land. And our most recent example there is Mad Max.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Fury Road. Absolutely. It's totally the search for the promised land. Oh, and I have to say, that is, you know, going back to what you were saying about, you know, big budget movies and that, or this and that, and, you know, yeah. But seriously, Mad Max, Fury Road, there was 20 minutes worth of movie in there. But I loved every second of the 2 hours of action.
Yeah.
It was just fabulous. And I think I need a 45-foot screen to be able to watch it again all the time. another very prevalent theme is what I call What a Doll. And it's about creating something that either does or doesn't work. And the Greek myth behind that was about Pygmalion, who was a sculptor. And he had a bad love experience. And he said, I'm off girls. I'm not going to, you know, girls are just not worth the trouble. So he said, I'll just make my own. So he carved this beautiful statue and called it Galatea. And it was very lifelike and very pretty. And he used to dress it up and fell in love with the statue and went to a festival for Aphrodite and prayed for his statue to come alive. And so Aphrodite, who's always favoring lovers, says, okay, I'll give this guy his wish. He goes home. His statue is coming to life. And sure enough, she does turn into a real live girl, and it all goes well for them. However, the more interesting stories are the dark side of this mythic theme, like, well, Frankenstein, or most recently, Ex Machina.
Mm-hmm.
So you create something. And you find this in a lot of religions, too, particularly in in many different religions. You find that a creator God says, oh, that was a mistake. And then you know, wipes out the entire populace except for a couple of people. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a repeating myth. And it can even be as simple as somebody saying, oh, I really love this person, but I want them to change. And then the person does change for them. And then, oh, I don't like that anymore. Well, never mind. Mm-hmm. So from the small little intimate stories to big stories that affect a lot of people, it's a good mythic theme, a lot of dramatic opportunity in there. And I've working on a second edition of my book, Beyond the Hero's Journey, and it's been so interesting to go back and visit some of these and update the examples, and it will be coming out probably in a month or so with a lot more of the mythic themes. I've identified, about 20 of them, and plenty of examples in each of them from mythology and then you know, plays and operas and movies and TV series, and these days, web series. So I would urge your filmmaker listeners to pick up a couple of books on mythology and start looking at it with, oh, you know, I know a movie that would fit this. Or, yeah, I've seen this story before. The trick for me, Jason, is we're all intuitively tuning into these things as artists. That's what we do.
Right.
It's the definition of an artist. You reach up there into the ooh-ooh sphere and you bring down things that other people just are not tuned to do. But the more consciously we can do it, the more effective our media can be.
Well, when you say the more consciously we can do it, what does that mean specifically? Well,
one of the things I find when I'm consulting on people's stories is that often, and let's just use a feature script as the example, there'll be three different mythic themes going on. And it's like the story isn't quite clear. It's like, well, what story are you really trying to tell?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So the first thing I do when working with clients is to identify the mythic theme. And then once you realize that, and let's say you're doing the search for the promised land, well, that's your main theme. And then your subplot theme is the what a doll. So once you've got those themes identified, what's the story you really want to tell? And line it up with these wonderful, items out of the collective consciousness and the collective unconscious of humankind, then you can start to use those classical plot points and strengthen your story. It's sort of like selecting a musical key or selecting a color palette. And once you start consciously aligning, not to be restrictive at all, and you can mix and match your plot points. There's no particular order, but you need to touch upon at least 6 of the usually 12 plot points, and then we'll get it. It's like a fractal thing. Mm-hmm. Once you create that little pattern, it automatically plugs us into the bigger pattern that lives in the mind of humanity.
It's really been a big help for me when I've been writing a lot. You know, I've gone through a lot of different processes of writing. And one was, you know, when I first started back in my 20s, I would just sit there and write. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have any sort of outline. I wouldn't have any sort of idea. And I was very naive. This was back when, you know, Kevin Smith and Quentin Tarantino and all these guys were big. And so I would just be like, oh, I'm just going to write a bunch of dialogue. And I didn't connect what was really going on in the film that I was, you know, that was sucking me into it. It was just like, oh, it's just funny dialogue, like Pulp Fiction. Oh, it's just two guys talking about stuff. And there's actually something much deeper going on that I wasn't quite capturing. But moving in, you know, after doing that, I got so frustrated with it, I would start outlining. And I just got to the point, I actually just wrote a post on this about how I would use outlining as a way of procrastinating. So I would just sit there and outline and outline and outline, and a month would go by and 2 months. And I was like, but it's not perfect yet. I have to do this and I have to do that. Then what I ended up doing after that is just kind of like having a general idea of what it was about and just jumping in and almost like improvising everything that was going on. And after I would look at what I kind of had there, I would start recognizing these patterns. And it's one of the things I got from, you know, I read Vogler's book about a year ago, and I started kind of putting together. It was like the first time that I really started understanding the concept of archetypes and, okay, all these things are coming naturally out of my own storytelling, but now I'm starting to connect it. Like this character is, say, like a gatekeeper, and this character is the Joker or the shapeshifter or things like that. You know what I mean? And it was like all of a sudden I started connecting things to a more universal thing, which is what I think that you're, you know, is kind of what you're describing. You know, it's like all of a sudden you're like realizing what these things in your story actually are.
Absolutely. And I think you've articulated well a process that many artists go through. And particularly writers, because we have such a freedom to create entire worlds without having to, you know, go out and buy land and bricks and build a building or, you know, paint to paint. It's a whole lot easier to do these experiments. But you're talking about that process of becoming conscious of the patterns that you're creating. Mm-hmm. And I think that's great. I think that's great. It's, I too find that a wonderful way to work. And I prefer that free form in the beginning. And I think probably most of us do, because so many things come in that you may not use right then, but hey, you've got a big slush pile, right? And it'll end up somewhere else too.
Yeah. Well, I just think that so many people are afraid to start. Yes. That if you just kind of have that, you know, the resistance that you have to start something because you put that pressure on yourself, if you just say, okay, this is going to be a terrible first draft. I'm just going to get it out and it's going to be what it is. And I'm going to write it really fast and just get it out there, you know. And then after you do that, going back and saying, okay, let's see some of the things that came out of putting up your creative antenna and things that just kind of like naturally happened that you weren't, you know. you come up with stuff at the end that you weren't necessarily aware of. And then it's like, okay, now I can rework some of the stuff at the beginning to make that work, you know?
Yes, absolutely. And another thing that I have found helpful, and some people do this and some don't, because we're all wired slightly differently,
mm-hmm.
is for me, I don't need to go in any linear fashion. So I may write a scene that's going to take place on page 80, and the next day write something on page 30. I'm not quite sure how they're going to fit together, but it's sort of like what I see and hear. And sometimes, I think for most of us who write, sometimes it's like you're just watching the movie in your head and writing it down.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And then exactly. Other times, you have to stitch it together, all those scenes that you did. But by working with, once again, these patterns of mythic themes and then the character things with the chakras going in after you've got that first flush of pure creativity down, then you can start working with and strengthening those patterns. But yeah, I still agree with you that that first just inpouring of the creative ideas is so exhilarating and fun. And yeah. But then, there's a wonderful thing on Facebook, and I reposted it, and it's a picture of this angel, you know, hovering above like the earth, and it's this glorious angel with fabulous wings and just all powerful. It's like, yeah, and it says how I feel when I'm writing my first draft. And then underneath it is a picture of someone just tearing their hair out, bent over the keyboard, you know, and there's. They're just distraught. And it says how I feel when I'm doing the rewrite. It's like, oh, yeah, we all know that.
Yeah, we've all been there. So can we I want to make sure we're covering everything. So I wanted to make sure we talk about archetypes because I had mentioned it. But I want to make sure that, you know, a lot of my listeners are at different stages of their career, writing wise, filmmaking wise. So I just want to make sure we cover the concept in general of archetypes and the archetype's journey through a film.
Oh, okay.
If we can do that.
Well, there are many, many archetypes, and there's a lot of good material out there about the archetypes. What I work with is called the archipaths.
Okay.
On the deeper levels of a number of the spiritual systems, mythological systems, there is the concept of the five paths. And these five paths are different ways, once again, of interacting with the world and expressing oneself in the world. And they are, and this is the origins of it are for us as individuals, but it's so beautifully adaptable to story characters. And those five paths are the path of the warrior, the path of the clergy, the scientist, the magician, and the lover. And any other archetype, whether it's the mother, the martyr, the orphan, the king, whatever, can fit into one of these paths. So there's a whole lot of flexibility, but by using these five paths, it's a lot less cumbersome. There's a whole lot more internal integrity. It's just easier to work with. And it's more, they are honed out of these eons old spiritual traditions, which are based on human psychology and, you know, group dynamics and sociology. And so they're very, very effective character development tools. As well as it's a lot of fun to do it yourself and, you know, analyze your friends too. So the path of the warrior, the clergy, the scientist, the magician, and the lover. And now each of these paths, let's say, here again, you could do the exercise. And when I teach classes on the archipaths, is to say, take a scene and for each of these paths, write your character coming from that particular path in the same setup scene, let's say, not the same dialogue, but it would be the same setup of a scene. And a character will go into it differently and speak differently if they're on the warrior path than if they're on the lover path. And there are different hopes and fears and strengths and weaknesses, styles of action, styles of speech. someone on a science path is going to speak much more distinctly and use much larger words.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
And perhaps want to analyze everything that's going on in order to make a very perspicacious and efficient decision. Whereas someone on the warrior path might come in and say, all right, take the hill, let's go. And someone on the magician path would approach it differently as well, etc. So using these paths, these archipaths, to align your characters and how they act and how they speak can make for very, very effective character portrayals. And then within each of these three paths, you have five paths, you have three levels. Just as many initiatory systems do, you've got the apprentice, and then you've got the journeyman, and then you've got the master. You've got the first level, second level, third level. So you take in the scientist path, what's so interesting, you go from being the student who wants to learn everything to being the scientist who's adept and knows what they're doing, and they've got it all down. The higher level is the philosopher, where they want to know the deeper answers to the deeper questions. On the warrior path, you've got the soldier who takes orders, doesn't think for themselves, is in training. You've got the warrior who's very, very good at what they do. They give orders to others, but they still serve a higher power. And that higher power then is the regent, the empress, the king, the general, whatever, the person who's in control of it all. So taking your characters up and down sometimes these levels can be very effective for character arcs. And putting characters on different paths against each other is also dramatic because you get a lot of conflict. You've got a clergy person on the clergy path and a person on the lover path. There are going to be some conflicts there.
Now, what when it's the clergy, what's an example of the clergy? Because I'm not really clear on that.
Okay. This is an interesting path in that it's about purity. Now, I've assigned each of the archipaths a P word. And the one for the warrior is purpose. Purpose and power. For the clergy, it's purity. I'll come back to the clergy in just a second. For the scientist, it is precision. And for the magician, it's performance. And then for the lover, it's passion. So someone on the clergy path is going to be very concerned about not being corrupted by the world. They withdraw from the world. And it can even be something as seemingly mundane as someone who says, oh, I've been overindulging. I need to detox. I'm going to start going to the gym. I'm going to go to the spa. I want to purify myself. Yeah, seriously, that's a moment on the clergy path, right?
Okay. I'm on the clergy path right now, then.
See? Yeah. The neat part about this, Jason, for us as individuals is we tend to shift these paths, whether it's from day to day, or over the course of our lives, we'll be on one path more than the other for a couple of years, or you know, sometimes for lifetimes. Some examples of the people on the clergy path would be in, of course, any of your, let's say, mythological stories like Mists of Avalon, or, you know, the robe, the chalice, the Ten Commandments, all of those. But then also in Pulp Fiction, Samuel L. Jackson makes a transition from the warrior path to the monk path, the clergy path. Mm-hmm. And in Thin Red Line, the hero there is on the clergy path. He's serving others. Avatar, you've got a very strong clergy path in there with the priestess and you know, all the people who are in that part of the society. And then on the dark side of it, you've got Spotlight. Mm-hmm. And that gets really interesting. So the clergy is about being in touch with the spiritual world, higher world, leaving the outside world and focusing inward and upward. So if someone withdraws or gets into disciplines, then they're more on the clergy path. And on the good side of it, it's about people often who want to bring, you know, light and love and transformation to others. So you can have a lot of service to others on that path. And then on the dark side of it, you can get, oh, well, take a look at fundamentalist religions of any stripe.
So I'm making a connection here between all of these different archipaths and also the concept of their chakras. Do you draw any like connection there, or is that like something I'm making up?
No, not at all. You are intuiting it correctly. The chakras will fit into any of the archipaths. Mm. So there will be different expressions of the chakras slightly differently on each path. But the nice thing about all these mythic tools is they all work in concert. They can mesh with each other. There's no conflict that I've found in working with this stuff for 24 years. They all fit together very nicely. So you can start at let's just take the warrior path, for instance. At the very bottom, the root chakra, you've got, when you're out there on the battlefield, you better be thinking of survival. So you're working from that very lowest root chakra, which is about fight or flight, sheer survival. Mm-hmm. And you often have to kill other people. So you're doing both sides of that. Going up to the sacral on the really dark side of it, rape is a tool of war. Mm-hmm. And there are all kinds of esoteric and exoteric reasons for that, you know, psychologically breaking down a people and, shattering their civil society and, you know, devastating them personally. On the lower solar plexus, you've got that, me and my platoon, me and my company, that warrior bonding thing that's very exclusive of others, but very tight, like tribal, like gangs. You know, it's all about us and my little group, and we're out there, and yeah. Mm-hmm. Higher up, aspirational solar plexus, still on the warrior path, chivalry, knighthood. The warrior is there to protect and defend the weak and the innocent, to help other people. And then on the throat chakra, which is about creativity, you've got all your, you know, the war machine, military-industrial complexes, setting up strategies, doing anything that's about logic and reason. And then you go on up to the Ajna, and you've got the commanders, people who are in charge because they can see the whole picture. So you can do a whole chakra run within each of these archipaths.
Right. Now, not to, you know, go into a completely different topic, and this is more controversial, but it seems like people's political parties would be determined by their chakra. You know what I mean? People who are just like gung-ho and just like, you know, I don't know. Okay, I don't want to get off into that, but it just seems very obvious.
It is very obvious, and there's there are a couple of books and about, unfortunately, I do not recall the name of the author, but indeed, he does point out that there are half a dozen or so, he doesn't call them chakra attitudes, but they are. And you can also look at Herbert Maslow's triangle pyramid of motivation, you know, personal motivation and personal growth, and you'll see a lot of the same things. Mm-hmm. But people who are operating from a lower solar plexus position, which is very exclusive, me and mine are the only ones that count, nobody else does, to the aspirational solar plexus, which is more about, hey, we're all in this together. Let's work this out so it works for everybody. And you can see in almost any situation, not just current politics, but it's a very entertaining example and kind of scary too these days. in not just our country, but all around, you get that split. You get the split. So you're absolutely right. And as with so many of these, ancient tools, they're based on, you know, hundreds and thousands of years of observation of human psychology.
So, yeah, I think it's really interesting, you know, especially if you, you know, my major in college was actually U.S. history.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So it's amazing going back into a lot of the things that happened before and the attitudes about things. And I think this is related to, you know, storytelling. That it's like we keep kind of repeating the same things over and over again, the same themes, the same concepts, the same ideas, you know, and there's a great documentary that's the conservative and liberal. I can't remember. I'm blanking right now on what it is, but it's like they have these arguments and it's both sides. And it's back in, I guess, the 1960s. Best of Enemies, I think it's called.
Oh, okay. I'll make a note of that.
And it's really good, but they're having the same exact arguments that we're having today. And it's just absolutely amazing that it's like, okay, we're, you know, infinitely into the future, we're going to keep having these same arguments about the same things because we as humans are coming from different places. We're having two different conversations and we see the world in completely different ways, you know?
Yes. And developmental psychology has even noted that you can pretty well tell around ages 3 to 5 which way a person's going to go, conservative or liberal, by the way they interact with others at that young age.
Right.
Yeah, it's, wow, American history. That you should probably do a whole bunch of podcasts just on that, you know, and showing us these recurring patterns. That would be so fascinating.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why I think what you're doing is so interesting, because it's like not just going back into a few hundred years, but it's going back into, you know, ancient stories and everything. Where do you find the most kind of, where would you say is the real origin of most of these stories? Are you, would you say like the Greeks mythology is where it kind of all begins?
Actually, no, that's the one most of us are familiar with, who've been brought up in, you know, Western civ culture. But going back even further than the Greco-Roman, you find when you study comparative mythology, and I would suggest to any of your listeners who really want to dive into this, it's a fascinating series, Joseph Campbell's four-part The Masks of God. No, let me see. I think it's The Masks of God. He's got, the first book is Primitive Mythology, and then Oriental Mythology, and then Occidental Mythology, and then just Future. So he goes way, way back in time and takes a look at all of the different cultures and their myths. There's also a very good book called, and it's very accessible. Anyone interested in mythology would do well to have this book. It's called When They Severed Earth from Sky, How the Human Mind Shapes Myth. And it's by a husband and wife team named Barber, B-A-R-B-E-R, When They Severed Earth from Sky. And they go way, way back, Jason, and show you how the same stories sprouted out of diverse, widely geographically separated cultures. So that's how you can then take the stand that myths are the stories we tell ourselves to explain the world around us and within us. So human psychology is pretty basically the same the world over, time immemorial, with a few changes here and there and different emphasis in different times and places. But the same stories keep being told. So go way, way back beyond the Greeks and the Romans and, you know, study Hindu mythology, study Oceanic mythology. And much of it has to do with, oh, here's something. It is said that a true myth is one that is true on at least 7 levels. And those could be geological, astronomical, sociological, psychological, philosophical, historical, geographical, cosmological. But there will be a truth and many truths within a mythic story, whether it's the story of a princess with flaming red hair and these two men were fighting over her and the earth shook and one of them, you know, cast a darkness over the sky. Well, it's a story of a volcano eruption that's been personified. And the princess with the flowing red hair is the volcano. And then one guy is the earth shaker. So there's the quakes that went along with it. And the other one is, and then the sky guy is the clouds and the vapors that cover the sky. But we tend to personify natural happenings as well as then creating characters that exemplify certain characteristics, whether it's greed or affection or good motherhood or hunting or rulers, you know, leadership, whatever.
I remember one of the things that I can't remember if this was Campbell or where I read it, but it was just the concepts that we have of so many things come from, you know, our very first years, like our concepts of gods and our concepts of just the way the world functions is so universally tied to our parents and the whole birth process and the way that human beings in general just like make sense of the world, how they develop. And so if you've got stories that are related from like completely different parts of the world, and we're kind of like taking that, you know, concept and putting it into our story, we're really tapping at something that's kind of at the core of humanity, at the core of like everybody's experience that's universal, you know?
Absolutely. And that's why working with mythic tools can help make your story more universal. Because you are indeed tapping into these psychological truths, into these sociological patterns, into this way we are. Absolutely. Absolutely right.
Now, when you were talking about the archipaths, are these, I want to talk a little bit about villains and bad guys and get into that a little bit. Are these the, you know, the warrior, clergy, scientist, magician, lover, are those, you said those can be like they, you can basically put any character into those categories. Is that right?
That is correct. And
okay, so even villains would fall into that same thing.
It is absolutely. Okay. And same thing with the chakras. I like to say, think of a spectrum, a sliding scale, for instance. And we'll jump to the archipaths right after this. But as an example, would be the lower solar plexus, which is all about personal power. On the weak side of it, you've got somebody who's like, oh, I don't know, just whatever you guys want. I don't care, whatever works for anybody else. A person with no boundaries, no personal strength. On the other side of it, the far side, you've got the bully, which is all about, hey, it's all about me, and you have to do it my way, and I'm going to beat you up if you don't. Then the balance in the middle is the person who has a strong self-identity, doesn't let other people run over them, but also does not take advantage of other people. Mm-hmm. So you've got the spectrum. Same thing with any of the archipaths. You've got the dark side and you've got the light side. You've got the evil scientist and you've got the scientist working for the cure of cancer. You've got on the lover path, you have the seductor who destroys people using their sexuality and their romantic charms. And then you've got the person, say, higher up on the lover path who is about bringing, you know, peace and love to many, many more people. Usually they're certainly in mythology, they tend to be more like the goddess queen of compassion, like Kuan Yin or Isis in the Egyptian mythology, the Virgin Mary. Somebody who's very much about love and bringing love to everybody. Mm-hmm. On the warrior path is probably the easiest to see, the villain side and the protagonist side. But any of those paths can really go wrong. And in the profiles that I use, there are, for instance, on the clergy path, the weaknesses are single-minded, fanaticism, being withdrawn, damaging their own body or the body of others.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And then the strengths would be devotion to the ideal and, you know, determination and yearning, aspirational. So villains, and coincidentally, I wrote the book called The Power of the Dark Side, which is, well, and oh, it was, I have to admit, Jason, it was a little depressing writing that book.
But, oh, yeah.
Man, the things people do to each other, huh? Tell ya. But yeah, a good villain is one who reflects the protagonist in some way and who will use many of the same tools to achieve their ends. So to create really interesting, engaging, complex villains, you need to use the same tools that you use to create complex, believable protagonists.
When you were writing your book, was there like a favorite villain that you really got into?
Oh, what a good question. Well, of course, I took the title from Star Wars, you know, soon you shall know the power of the dark.
All right.
I just always loved that phrase. I suppose, and this will sound a little bit out there, but I suppose my favorite villain actually is Willem Dafoe in Streets of Fire,
mm-hmm.
which is a rock and roll fable from the early 70s. And Diane Lane is the heroine, and Willem Dafoe plays this biker, really bad biker dude. It's just so over the top. But Walter Hill directed it, and John Milius, the fabulous writer, wrote the screenplay. And it's funny, but it's so well done. He makes a wonderful villain. So I think that would be my favorite one as far as just, you know, yeah, I like to watch this guy be bad.
Well, okay, so talking about the five different archipaths. What about when a character starts, say, for example, starts out as an apprentice magician, is really nice and happy, you know, and whatever, and suddenly they take a turn for the dark side? I mean, where does that fall? Can people, you know, as they're getting higher, is there kind of a typical pattern of somebody starting to get more power and then kind of be tempted by the dark side, I guess?
Oh, I am so glad you asked that. That's very good. And I need to remember to start including this in my lectures. In the mystery schools, the spiritual systems, mystical systems, it's said that the magicians of the white and the magicians of the black take the same training up to a certain point. And that point is when you start to enter the third level, and it's the point where you're called upon to do self-sacrifice for the good of others. The dark magicians just say, nah, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. And the ones who go on to the path of light will put themselves in danger. A very good example of that process is in the Lord of the Rings series, mm-hmm. where Gandalf the Grey, who's at the second level of the magician path, right, in the clergy magician path, Gandalf the Grey stands on that bridge and denies the Balrogs that you shall go no further.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives his own life to protect the fellowship and to protect, you know, lots and lots and lots of other people. So he passes that test of loving self-sacrifice. Now, it doesn't always mean death, but for him, of course, it did. But he comes back as Gandalf the White. So he passes the test. Obviously, his nemesis in the tower went the side of the dark. So you want to have in your story a point in time where the person who's going to the dark side is given a choice. And it has to be a real choice between doing something where they have to give something up for the good of other people. And once again, it doesn't have to be life or death. It could be, you know, giving up a love. It could be giving up a position. You know, anything. All the way to, of course, death. Mm-hmm. And they don't do it. So selflessness or selfishness is the pivot point where the magician, all of whom have trained up to the same point in the same way, then they make the split. And you can see that reflected also in the second trilogy, which is the prequel trilogy for Star Wars with Anakin.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got, he's not on the magician path, but just another bridge symbolism thing was in this most recent movie where Han Solo goes out on the bridge and sacrifices his own life for the good of others.
Spoiler alert.
No. You mean you have people in your audience?
No, no, just kidding, sir.
Shame for shame.
If you haven't seen Star Wars, The Force Awakens, then don't download my podcast. You don't, yeah. You don't deserve it. No, I made the mistake of, I was thinking about this last night when I was walking out of the movie theater that my wife and I was like, I have to go see The Force Awakens, you know, the first day that it was out. And she kept saying, I can't believe Han Solo got killed. I was like, shut up, you know, because there are like people in line. And I was just like, what's the big deal? And I was like, you know, these people will literally, I mean, people dressed like Chewbacca and stuff, you know, it's like, don't, I was like covering her mouth.
Oh,
it was like, please. Anyway, sorry. So when you, when you're dealing with people who are not dealing with, but when you're talking and analyzing screenplays and helping people out, what do you think are the biggest kind of pitfalls? What are the red flags you see with writing? What's probably the biggest correction or help you're giving to them?
Oh, okay. Good question. There are actually a couple of things that in my consultations or in, you know, just workshops that we talk about, there are, I'd say, four things. And one of them is being unclear on the theme, not knowing what your story is about. Trying to say too much within a story. You know, it's one thing if you're writing a very long novel, but if you're writing a screenplay, screenplay is a short story. If you're doing a TV series, you've got a little bit more room, and certainly with web series, it needs to be, you know, pretty sharply delineated. What is your theme? What is it that you're trying to say? So getting very clear on that is important as a first step. The next problem is, this is so consistent with any of us. I mean, I go back and look at my first scripts and go, oh my goodness, what was I thinking? Oh, I wasn't. is to have undifferentiated characters where all your characters sound the same. And it's one of the hardest things for people to do until they've become a bit more conscious of the writing craft. Now, some people just get it naturally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yay for them. But for most of us, we have to work at making sure that our characters don't sound like each other. I had a client once who said, but all my characters are in the upper class of this particular system, so of course they're all going to talk alike.
Mm-hmm.
They may use the same type of vocabulary, but no, one of them may be more short, and someone else is more eloquent, and someone else is this. Your characters need to sound different. That's mm-hmm. where the archipaths and the chakras can come in very, very handy. So, you know, once again, that exercise I suggested where you take a scene and or just an idea you want a character to get across and write it from what you perceive would be the warrior, clergy, scientist, magician, or lover attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And even if it's, let's go to the store. They'll each say it differently, or they should. So get clear on the theme, differentiate your characters. Another big one is the dialogue is too on the nose.
Mm-hmm.
And in documentary, I'm sure you know this, in documentary filmmaking, there's a conceit called, are you talking to picture or away from picture? Mm-hmm. In your narration, are you talking about what we're seeing on screen that's talking to picture? Or are you talking away from picture, where the words are saying something different than what we're seeing on screen?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So they're giving us additional information or something we're going to see next or historical background, whatever. Well, in fiction, you pretty much don't want to talk to picture. You don't want somebody to say, oh, look, the bomb just went off. Well, yeah, duh. We could tell that. Mm-hmm. So tell us something different. And, oh, here's a fun thing. My little nephews love to do this. You say, let's try to go 3 hours without saying anything obvious. It's hard.
And I need to start that game at my house.
Yeah, seriously. Oh, it's cloudy. Yeah, we can all see that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. So not to have your dialogue too on the nose. Linda Sager has a book on subtext, which would be a good addition to your.
Yeah, I love Linda. She was on the show. She's one of my first interviews.
Oh, she's fantastic.
Yeah, she was great. It was great.
Linda's really good, really good. So check out her book on subtext so that your dialogue isn't all on the nose. Mm-hmm. Then the fourth thing is too much exposition and description. Scripts that have, I've had one client, and he really made fantastic improvements, but his first draft that I saw was describing a scene in a cafe, and he described every moment of every movement. He lights a cigarette, then lifts it to his mouth. He puffs. He blows out the smoke.
Right.
She walks over, looks down. It was like he had leaves something for the director and actors to do. So just cutting back on description and exposition.
Right. Yeah, I think that a lot of that comes from reading a lot of screenplays. You know, if you read a lot of very good screenplays, you realize very quickly that, you know, they are filmmakers telling you a story. So it's not about necessarily a writer. Does that make sense? It's like they're putting it in front of you like it's a movie. It's not like reading, you know, Hemingway or something where they have to describe everything to you so you get a feel for it or whatever, you know. And there's so few rules, you know, as long as you convey what you're kind of imagining, you can kind of like do your own thing, you know?
Very much so. A recent example that I experienced was our screenplay our screenplay was a winner at the Bahamas International Film Festival.
And oh, great.
It was fantastic. We got to go to the Bahamas for a week. I would encourage all your writers. Enter contests
in cool places.
Yeah, cool places, big cash prizes, but cool places is almost as better than that. So, a friend of mine has a book club, and she said, "Well, I'd like for our book club members to read your script." I said, "Oh, well, you know, they're civilians, and it's, you know, reading the script, the book. Okay, but tell them to read it all in one go." So, I was very pleased and surprised that. Of course, these are, you know, smart people, but they got it. And one of the examples in there of sneaking in some description is we had a description of someone going down into the barrio in Havana and going to this dive club. And the description was the street outside smelled of whiskey and anger. No, we're not in smell-o-vision. But I think it gives your production designer, your actors, your director a lot to work from if you can put in things like that, but you don't go into great detail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get that. You know, when I was reading some of James Gunn's screenplays, I read his Day of the Dead screenplay. And the whole time I was reading through it, I was like, oh, he's not supposed to do that. He's not supposed to do this. And he's putting you can't see that on the screen. And it's like, no, but he's really entertaining you. You know, he's really pulling you into the story and breaking every single rule that, you know, supposedly people are saying, oh, well, you're not supposed to do that or do this or whatever. And it's like, at the end of the day, it's like people are going to read screenplays and they want to be entertained and they want to know that it's going to be a, you know, there's going to be people laughing in a theater, you know? So it's like, there are certain things that you don't. I mean, I've got other friends who send me their screenplays, and it's got stuff that's like, definitely you don't want to put this in there because that doesn't translate. A producer will look at that and be like, you know, this guy doesn't know what he's doing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Too true. Now you've got me. I just wrote down that I have to go read James Gunn Day of the Dead script. So thank you.
Yeah, I try to do that as much as possible because, you know, so many people, you know, there's just so much like gray space. And I'm one of these people that really likes to feel comfortable that what I'm writing is like right. You know, because I was never good at writing when I was in school, but I write all the time now. I mean, I write blog posts and I write articles and screenplays and whatever, but it's all from a creative standpoint, but from a technical standpoint, it's terrible. So I've always gotten really insecure about that. And then I read that, you know, like George Lucas was also a terrible writer and he had terrible spelling and he had a secretary that would basically correct all of his errors so that when it went out, it would look good, you know?
Oh.
But it's like if at the creative core of it all, you're creating interesting stories, then you don't have to be so obsessed about, oh, well, you know, is every little thing right, you know?
Yep, true. And you can hire people to do the formatting and editing for you.
Right.
It's just not your thing. But I think you're addressing more the concepts. Well, let's say that the conceits and the stylistic protocols that are supposedly the rules of Hollywood and script writing. But yeah, breaking those and creating an entertaining read, because even if you're not going to a studio or a production company to look for funding or a pickup, and it's so difficult these days to do that anyway, but you're writing a web series, you want the actors that you're going to hand the script to want to be part of your production. And hopefully do it for free or deferred money.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, absolutely, you're right. You've got to have an entertaining script, regardless of whether it's a comedy or a drama or tragedy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess, I mean, one of the things that really I think people forget a lot, and it's something that we've talked about here, is the notion that, you know, at the heart of a screenplay, you know, I love the idea that we can, you know, have these structures and these, you know, old like stories that have been passed down from generation to generation, because as creative people, it's very hard to stay on the rails because your mind goes in a million different directions. And it's like, okay, if I kind of know how to keep myself grounded with this classic story, then I can allow myself to be creative and I can allow myself to go in all these different directions as long as I know that I'm somewhat grounded in this basic story structure.
Yes. Yes. It does provide a good foundation and structure, a scaffolding, if you will.
Right.
Well, I guess that's probably not a good choice of words. What is the extent of a hangman's noose? An example I like of a movie that touches upon the plot points of a story and yet reverses the linear structure is, once again, my favorite film, Apocalypse Now, where we get the mythic statement, the lesson statement, and the thematic statement, the mission statement, and the lesson statement, which are usually spread out over a story, all in the first opening scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And you've seen, you know, Hearts of Darkness, so you know why a lot of that happened, that restructuring of the story and the narration, voiceover. It's very interesting. I think your filmmaking audience would benefit from and hopefully enjoy watching from a filmic point of view, Apocalypse Now and the documentary about it, because there's some excellent filmmaking involved there.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, we used to watch the Flight of the Valkyrie scene. I had a friend who, back when I was in college, had Laserdisc and surround sound system and a big subwoofer. And he would just, that was his scene that he would watch every single time he wanted to kind of show everybody the power of his surround sound system.
Oh,
was that scene. And it was insane. I mean, you could hear it, you know, a couple of blocks down the street, the choppers and everything. I mean, and this is like, you know, Laserdisc time. I mean, this was, I guess, like 95 or something. And it was insane. I mean, it was crazy. So that was really the first time I actually got to experience Apocalypse Now, other than just watching it on a VHS, you know, like on the little TV. It was amazing.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Oh, well, you are fortunate because that is the way to see it. Indeed. Yeah, I fortunately got to see it when it first came out at the Dome Theater, Cinerama Dome here in Hollywood.
Oh, man, that would have been amazing. That's like the best movie. I think the best thing, when I lived in L.A., I lived right around the corner from the Cinerama Dome.
Oh.
And they had this kind of, I guess they have film festivals there all the time, but I got to see Lawrence of Arabia and Close Encounters and all. I mean, it was just like heaven for me.
Oh, you know? Yes.
And now it's like, I can't, you know, there's nothing like that in Merida, but, you know, but I mean, I was just like, I mean, Lawrence of Arabia was insane. I had seen it on like a little screen, and this was like, I guess we were watching the 70 millimeter print. It was just like the most amazing experience I ever had.
Isn't it?
What I miss about LA so much is just all the, like, the love of film, you know?
Mm-hmm. And the technological places that are good to watch it in. You're so right. It's, you know, I think it's wonderful, all the transmedia and the different platforms we have to watch stories. But I seriously, do you want to watch Lawrence of Arabia on your smartphone? You don't.
Yeah, I don't even want to watch it on my big screen, you know, flat screen TV. It's just not the same. I mean, whenever I try to go to the theater as much as I can, you know, it's changing so much now, you know, and it's getting harder and harder, and less movies are coming to. I mean, here at least it's changed, you know. Well, let me ask you that, actually. I mean, since you've been in the industry and seen the change in technology and everything, what are you seeing big changes in the way things are being produced and made? I mean, what are there any kind of major things that you've really noticed that are changing? I guess that's really broad, isn't it?
Well, I'd say yes, and. And the and would be something I had said before. You know, story is still story, no matter the platform. Mm-hmm. And production is still production, no matter the size of the budget or how much equipment you have. It's like an hourglass. You know, things go in through a lens and come out on the other side. But what I've seen is, I think in many ways, a very good thing. When I first came out here, it was the major studios and a few independent companies. But everything was pretty well controlled by the majors. And then there were commercials and documentaries, of course. But when control started to erode from the studios and you started to get more people able to afford cameras and afford to do editing, and there were other means of distribution, then you had a whole lot more people coming into the creative industry. And that was through music videos and documentaries, commercials, sort of the hybrid between corporate and drama. And it's just kept burgeoning so that now you can make, you don't have to have a $2,500 a day Panavision 35 millimeter camera and a crew where you're spending, you know, $10,000 a day at the low end of it. Mm-hmm. To, you know, $100,000 a day to produce your movie, you can do it with your iPhone. And it's opened up so much creativity. I was just at the Los Angeles Web Fest 2 weekends ago, and the production value is astonishingly good. And the stories are engaging and moving and entertaining. And so that vast difference, Jason, between having a monolithic vertical tube controlling system to this anybody anywhere can do anything they want to and show it to practically anybody, unless you're in a country that, you know, disallows YouTube or whatever. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's been the biggest change, the democratization of media. Mm-hmm. And yet, once again, there are still story protocols and production protocols that you better well follow or you're not going to turn out with a good product. And certainly one that we saw improving over the years from the LA Web Fest when it first started 7 years ago was, oh, the sound was atrocious. Mm-hmm. Sound is the most important thing. And you can even have bad cinematography, bad acting, but if you got bad sound, you got to turn it off.
Yep.
So always have a professional sound person and equipment. And then the other thing was production design. Don't just mm-hmm. blank walls. It reeks of student film. Do some work. Get some symbolism in there. You know, decorate the sets. It mm-hmm. makes all the difference in your storytelling.
Yeah.
But yeah, the biggest changes to me are caused by technology and the democratization of media. And I am seeing, and I hope this continues, that a lot of people are using media not only to entertain, but also to inform and educate and enlighten people.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about the money.
Definitely.
In some cases, unfortunately, there's no money.
Yeah. I would say most people that are out there making indie films aren't doing it for the big, quick money grab.
No.
I hope they're not.
At the WebFest, though, there are always people from the studios that come there looking for talent. And they say, we look for writers and filmmakers and actors in the web series. They consciously are scouting web series and indie films, mm-hmm. looking for talent to pick up. So it's not like it can't happen, but the immediacy of being able to do what you love to do is fantastic.
Yep. Well, Pamela, I really appreciate your time. Do you want to talk a little bit about where people can find you online or about your services, your consulting a little bit, just so we have that?
Oh, thank you. Yes. They can go to my website, which is mythworks.net, MYTHWORKS, mythworks.net. You can also get there by going to PamelaJSmith.com, and the J is all spelled out, JAYE. So PamelaJSmith.com. And there they can find articles and interviews and information about the consulting services and books. Downloads of seminars, all such as that. And I would offer to your audience, if they like, a 10% discount on any of my consulting services. And they just need to mention you and, you know, IFA, and they'll get a 10% discount. And the consulting services go from a brainstorming. We can just have a brainstorming session in which I would help you identify themes and maybe a couple of the arc paths that will help you get more clear on the way you're going. I do script coverage, that is, you know, like the standard formats where you say this works, that works, this doesn't, this is excellent, good, fair, poor. So brainstorming and coverage, and then I do full script consultations as well, ranging from a good solid coverage to very, very detailed. And have even done some where I go all the way through production and have even had somebody, oh, it was on a Wes Craven film. They called up and the last day of shooting, they said, oh, what color should the floor be there at in this guy's his hideout? What color should we paint the floor? So the consultations can go all the way from your initial idea up through shooting, you know, whatever. And also work not only with screenwriters, but novelists, people doing memoirs need to tap into a mythic theme. Mm-hmm. And can help with any particular type of problem. Some people will come and say, oh, having a hard time with the dialogue. Okay, well, let's look at that. Mm-hmm. Someone else, it might be, my structure seems a little sloppy. I'm not sure what to do, so we'll work on that. And I also do personal consulting so that people can find out what is their arc-a-path, what path are they on, and how they can better strengthen that and use maybe some things that they've learned from being on a different path.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And where they might be going. And that's a lot of fun for creative people too.
Yeah. Do you find that a lot of people, like, they will have characters who have their chakra changes and it's like, it's not like consistent through the story?
Yes.
Like, it's like all of a sudden you're like, wait a second, that's not the same character that you were writing about in the scene before.
Right, right. So using the tool of the chakras, and my book for that is Inner Drives.
Okay.
You need internal integrity within your characters. And so when they do change, then we do want to know that it's you mean for them to change rather than it's just like, oops, they wouldn't talk that way.
Right. Okay.
Oh, and an excellent film to watch for a chakra drop is Gladiator, where you've got the Russell Crowe character at the very height of the chakra system. And then he is slammed down to the very bottom and has to fight his way back up. So it's a really excellent example of doing a chakra run, clawing his way back up.
No, it's really amazing, you know, covering those five different archetypes. It's like you start, you know, it kind of ruins movies now, you know.
Dear.
I mean, in a good way, like in terms of just analyzing it. Now I think I'm going to start watching stuff and being like, okay, what are they doing? Where, what level are they? Where's this chakra going? You know, my wife's going to think I'm nuts. Well, thank you so much for your time. Is there anything else we need to mention here? Is there anything else you wanted to, I don't want to just leave anything unsaid, undone.
All right. Well, let's see. If anybody is in the Los Angeles area or is coming in for the Great American Pitch Fest, it is the 20th through the 22nd of May, right around the corner. And if they're thinking of going and haven't already bought their tickets, they can use my secret code and get a 10% discount. And that code is PJ Smith, all capital letters, for the Great American Pitch Fest. And you can come, even if you don't have anything ready to pitch, you can also just come to the classes and panels on Saturday. So they can just go to the Great American Pitch Fest website, find out all about it. And the code again is PJ Smith, all capitals.
Okay. Perfect.
And thank you so much. This has been a really interesting conversation. You may have heard me typing. I've been taking notes on a lot of
me
said.
Too, yeah. No, I really enjoyed it, and I appreciate your time. We've gone like an hour and a half, so, you know, I really appreciate your time, and, you know, it's been great. I think our writers and our filmmakers will get a lot out of this. I love whenever we have a podcast where we're talking about things that we've never even kind of touched on, and this has definitely touched on some concepts that are very new. Well, new to me, at least.
Well, good. And I'm so pleased to be doing this for a group of independent filmmakers. And in the course of my career, I've been really lucky to work at a major studio, as well as, you know, wildly independent, have traveled the world for work. Mm-hmm. And it's been fantastic and learned so many things about so many different things. It's a wonderful, wonderful world for anybody in the independent world, and these days so many more opportunities. So best of luck to all of your writers and filmmakers.
Well, thank you so much, Pamela. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to Inside the Screenwriter's Mind at screenwritersmind.com.